You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight. We're going to talk about the Spanish Civil War in the early part of the 20th century. But in order to understand the Spanish Civil War, I want to first of all explain a little bit about fascism and what it is. After the First World War, there was a strong feeling in the countries of Europe that the liberal democratic parliamentary systems just had not worked. Many reasons for that. One was that liberal democracies of England and France had helped plunge Europe into a miserable war. Between the wars, many parliamentary democracies had unstable governments. In Spain and Italy, for example, governments would rise and fall so fast that hardly anybody could keep track of them. And even in countries that were stable, like the United States, people realized that elections sometimes led to political corruption and power for the wealthy. Many of the post-war liberal governments were unable to keep order or even to stabilize their own economies. Therefore, the people in Europe were looking for strong governments. They wanted order much more than they wanted elections and parliaments. In many of these countries, this need for order was met by fascism. Fascism means government without elections or a parliament. One strong man is head of state. Fascism promised order and stability, and fascist movements appeared in many countries. Fascism is a form of government, in itself neither good or evil. Everything depends on the man who comes to power. A fascist government can be pro-Catholic or anti-Catholic. Portugal was ruled wisely by a fascist government, led by Antonio Salazar from 1932 until he died in 1971. In Romania, the fascist and deeply Catholic Legion of the Archangel Michael, which required its members to be willing to die for Christ, provided strong opposition to liberalism and communism. Much too often, however, the strong man ruler can become power hungry and become a despot or tyrant. Such was the case in Italy. In 1919, Benito Mussolini formed the Italian Fascist Party, which took its name from the fasces, an ancient Roman symbol for power. The fasces is a group of sticks that are bound together in the shape of a larger stick. They're much more powerful than a single stick of similar size. It's hard to break. In 1921, communists and fascist riots in Florence marked the beginning of the civil war between the two factions. The fascists drove out the communist government in Bologna and seized Milan. Then in October, they marched on Rome, occupying the city. The king called on Mussolini to form a government and granted him dictatorial powers. The fascist party won the elections, of course, with help of manipulation and force. Thanks for orderly. Everyone over here in the United States was looking at fascism in Europe with admiration. And what about Mussolini? At first, Mussolini was popular. He was even popular in the United States. At that time, there was a hit song by Cole Porter, which contained these words in a long list of superlatives. You're the top. You're Mussolini.
You're the nimble trade of the feet of great affair. You're Mussolini.
You're Mrs. Sweeney, you're coming.
Everyone acclaimed him, especially the liberals on the left side. He remained popular for decades. Mussolini established order and increased industrial production, thereby ending unemployment, and gave the Italians pride in their country. He increased his popularity with a treaty granting the Pope his own independent territory, the Vatican City, ending the Pope's status as prisoner of the Vatican. So if Francisco Franco in Spain was opposed by people in this country, it was not because he was fascist. It was for other reasons. The fascist Mussolini was looking good. Gradually, though, Mussolini's rule became increasingly despotic, and Pope Pius XI wrote an encyclical condemning the fascists for their pagan values. Of course, I'm talking about Italian fascism, but talking about what happened in Italy gives a little background to what happened in Spain and led to the riots of the fascist ruler Franco in Spain.
A royal house of the rightful kings of Spain was defeated. Spain brought upon itself more suffering than could have been realized. During the first third of the 20th century, the government was unstable, the people extremely unhappy. Who came to power was a man named Azana. He was an atheist. He closed Catholic schools, expelled the Jesuits from Spain, took religious symbols off the walls of the Spanish public buildings. Spain divided into two groups, the nationalists and the republicans. The nationalists were the traditionalists, were Catholic. The republicans or revolutionaries were atheists and agnostics. And many were communists. Many were even from the Soviet Union, and arms and tanks flowed in from the Soviet Empire. On the nationalist side, therefore, was the Catholic Church, most of the army, the Falange, or Phalanx, a fascist party which tended toward violence as a solution to problems, but had the one virtue of being strongly anti-communist. Also, some supporters of the kings, the Carlists, they called them, after King Carlos, the Carlists, and the CEDA, a moderate traditional party. On the Republican side were socialists, the communists, the anarchists, and other liberal groups. I know this name, Republican, is confusing to us. Each side was composed of disparate elements, but let's simplify it for ourselves. The right and the left. We have a somewhat right-wing nationalist side and a somewhat left-wing Republican side. So a party from the right wing, the CEDA, won the election, but scandals discredited the party. So a combination of leftist groups, the Popular Front, was elected. Under the leadership of Largo Caballero, they began attacking the church, confiscating all religious properties. Many priests and nuns were murdered with the help of the government. On one occasion, the leftists put a statue of the Sacred Heart before a firing squad. There's a famous photograph of that. As the attacks on the church increased and the government became clearly communist, a group of generals on the right-wing side began planning an uprising against the Popular Front. In recognition of the fact that the Popular Front was communist, they were now called the Reds. An important leader on the right was murdered by the police, inspired two of the generals to set a date for a revolution, an uprising of the army against the government. Now, all of this was momentous because one of these generals was destined to become the leader of Spain for many decades after this, Francisco Franco. Franco issued a proclamation calling for the reestablishment of authority in Spain. The greatest support for the uprising came from the province of Navarra, a stronghold of the Carlists. Military of the right wing, or Carlists, had been training in Navarra. Franco sent a call to Navarra for 600 men to fight the government. In just one day, 40,000 men answered the call. He asked for 600, he got 40,000. Throughout the Civil War, 100,000 of these men were in the field at all times, fighting for the church, for Spain, and for their families. The uprising came to be called the Crusade, the Cruzada, because it was a holy war against Christ's enemies. Franco needed help, however, to transport his troops across the Straits of Gibraltar from Morocco northward into Spain. Nobody would help him. The United States wouldn't help him. France wouldn't help him. Britain wouldn't help him. The only countries that were helping were Italy and Germany. The right wing, Franco and the nationalists, received aid from Nazi Germany and Mussolini's Italy. German planes fought on the nationalist side, and about 14,000 Italian and 7,000 German troops helped Franco. Franco was severely criticized for accepting aid from Hitler, but Franco personally had no use for Hitler or Nazism. But what was he to do? An example of this is that when World War II broke out, Hitler held a meeting with Franco to persuade him to occupy Gibraltar, taking it away from the British and allowing the Germans to use it as a naval base to block off the Mediterranean Sea. That would have been such a strategic move that very likely Hitler would have won the Second World War. But as I said, Franco had no use for Hitler. He saw through the man. And he refused, stubbornly refused. After the meeting, Hitler said, "I would rather have all my teeth pulled than talk to that man again." So, needless to say, Hitler didn't get Gibraltar. But Franco needed to get arms and weapons from somewhere, and the Germans and the Italians were the only ones that would help him. The left wing, the atheist side, the Republicans, received arms, technicians, trainers, officers from communist Russia in return for two-thirds of the entire gold reserve of Spain. This was about 300 million at the time. Fighting for the atheists were also the Communist International Brigades. These were volunteers from various countries who fought under communist leadership. One of them is the Abraham Lincoln Brigade from the U.S., in which many U.S. citizens who were artists and authors, intellectuals, fought for the atheist side. Finally, there was about 20,000 troops in these brigades in Spain in 1936 alone. The communist involvement was made most obvious in the treatment of nuns, priests, and brothers, and in the acts of sacrilege against Catholic churches in areas under the control of the left wing. The war lasted for almost 3 years, but the battle which best symbolizes the issues of the war and how they were resolved was fought in the first 3 months. The battle is called the Siege of Alcazar in Toledo. Toledo is an ancient city about 40 miles from Madrid. Ferdinand and Isabella had once made it their capital and had built a great church there. The Moslems had earlier built a fort on one of Toledo's hills, and Charles V later made the fort into a royal palace. This fort and palace was known as the Alcazar. And of course, there was a military garrison at Toledo, commanded by a man who was a very strong Catholic and a fine soldier, Colonel Mascardo. What took place there was the Battle of Alcazar. And we'll talk more about that after the break. On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coffin setting the record straight about the glorious history of the Catholic Church.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. And this is Setting the Record Straight. Let's take up the story of the Battle of Alcazar, where we left off before the break. So when Colonel Mascardo received an order from the atheist Republicans, the communists, to send the ammunition from Toledo's munitions factory to Madrid, he delayed as long as he could, and then finally issued a declaration of war. The Republican troops invaded the town. Mascardo, his troops, and some civilians retreated uphill into the Alcazar, where they prepared to withstand the enemy. In the fort of Alcazar, there were 1,760 people, 211 children. The left wing, the Reds, had devised a trick to make Mascardo surrender. The communist leader, Cabello, telephoned Mascardo saying, "I give you 10 minutes to surrender the Alcazar. If you don't, I shoot your son, Luis, who is standing here beside me." Mascardo's face did not betray his feeling. "I believe you," he said. Cabello said, "And so you can see it's true. He will speak to you." Luis was given the phone. Mascardo said, "What is happening, my boy?" "Nothing," Luis answered. "They say they're going to shoot me if the Alcazar does not surrender. But don't worry about me." "If it is true," replied Mascardo, "commend your soul to God. Shout, 'Viva España!' and die like a hero. Goodbye, my son. A kiss." "Goodbye, Papa. A very big kiss." Then Mascardo told Caballo, "You might as well forget the 10 minutes. The Alcazar will never surrender." As the siege went on, food supplies became lower and lower. Finally, they were forced to kill and eat their horses to avoid starvation. A month later, on August 1st, the leftists began a heavy bombardment of the walls. 3 days later, 170 heavy shells hit the walls. 2 weeks later, 200 shells. By the end of August, most of the north wall. By the end of August, most of the north wall had been destroyed. On September 8th, they again asked Mascardo to surrender. He refused, and heavier bombing was ordered.
Seeing the Alcazar still standing, one of the Republican communist leaders said, "If we had a few, just a few, like that on our side, the war would soon be over." The Republican communist then began digging a mine under the Alcazar in an attempt to blow it up. The defenders of the Alcazar could hear the digging but could do nothing because of a layer of bedrock over the mine. They evacuated everyone from the area of the mine and prayed. The Republicans announced that the mine would be exploded on the morning of September 18th, and reporters from all over the world came to watch what they were certain would be the fall of the Alcazar. At 6:30 in the morning, the mine went off with an explosion so loud it could be heard in Madrid, 40 miles away. But because of the defenders' precautions, no one was killed. Ironically, the rubble from the explosion helped to make a new barricade protecting the Alcazar. Communist troops attacked again and again, but were driven off. By mid-morning, the attack had ended. At that time, Franco was leading his troops to attack Madrid. He postponed that because they were getting near Toledo. He decided to bring relief to the brave defenders of the Alcazar. Another mine was exploded, but the attack was again fought off. In the evening, Franco arrived with his nationalist troops, and the Alcazar was saved. 92 soldiers had been killed, but not a single woman, not a single child, was lost. And 2 babies were born during the siege. The story of the courage of the defenders of the Alcazar spread rapidly throughout Spain. It symbolized the determination of the Spanish traditionalists to fight for death for the Catholic Church, for their country, for all the values they loved. When Franco finally marched into Madrid in March of 39, the Republicans surrendered. The nationalist victory was due to the kind of spirit that had inspired the men, women, and children in the Alcazar. Franco began his long rule of Spain, but he was not popular in this country. The communist propaganda was at a height, subverting our media and in Hollywood and academia, and it was already having an effect. World War II was about to begin. Franco refused to join either side. After 3 years of bloodshed, the last thing Spain needed was another war. After World War II, the civilized world turned against Spain and refused to provide any trade or aid. This caused a famine. Many people starved to death. Many nuns starved to death in their convents. But somehow Spain survived. But still, the Americans and the British refused to send any food at all. I want to be sure not to give the wrong impression. Francisco Franco led his side into committing many atrocities. Some people have called it the Spanish Holocaust. Some people have called it the White Terror. But it was counterbalanced by the Red Terror. There were atrocities on both sides. When viewing this terribly inhumane record of both sides in this war, it's difficult to find anyone to praise except the individuals who were martyred and the individuals who suffered from it. But if we are to condemn Franco for his inhumane record, then we must also acknowledge the good that he did. Spain had been through decades of government after government. The country was in chaos and poverty. Franco brought peace, order, and prosperity, a foundation upon which people could go about their lives and earn a living. It kept that peace, order, and prosperity for over 35 years. His government was not ideal, but it was far better than everything that had preceded it for a generation. The Spanish Civil War is one of the most important events of the 20th century. The communists suffered a decisive defeat after having apparently achieved a complete victory. The rest of Europe, however, was not as fortunate as Spain. The Spanish had defeated atheism and dictatorship. The rest of Europe had yet to suffer from these evils. Just a few months after Spain defeated the communist enemy, Hitler unleashed his Nazi army on Europe, and World War II began. In final analysis, one could be certain of what Spain would have looked like had the atheistic, communistic, left wing won. One only has to look at the Soviet Union and its slave states, and the inhumane treatment that they perpetrated on their captive nations, on hundreds of millions of people, until the fall of the Berlin Wall. There were problems with Spain. Spain was not heaven on earth, but it was a far, far better place than the hell experienced by the people in any communist nation, especially those behind the Soviet's Iron Curtain. I want to take a few moments to just give a few incidents, tiny little vignettes for the persecution of the Catholic clergy. There's no way I could describe it all. By any standards, the priests and nuns in Spain were far from participation or responsibility in the political situation, but that did not protect them. For in the Republican view, they were objective class enemies. The martyrdoms began. It's 1936. Three Jesuits and a Jesuit brother were captured and taken from a retreat house to anarchist headquarters in Barcelona. Anarchist crowds reported to have shouted, "We're going to kill you because you're priests. Not one of you will be left." They were taken to a hill, absolved one another, expressed forgiveness for their captors, and were shot. 2 days later in the same city, 12 nuns, four over 60 years old, were gunned down by the side of a road. The same day in Toledo, Father Pascual Martin was shot in front of St. Nicholas Church and died shouting the slogan of the Cristeros de Mexico, "Viva Cristo Rey," Hail Christ the King. The rector of the Toledo Seminary and the priest who was head of the Brotherhood of Diocesan Priests were shot and killed in front of a hospital. One of the most brutal atrocities of the whole Civil War happened in Madrid itself. Three discalced Carmelite nuns, members of the movement inaugurated by the great 16th century Spanish mystic, St. Teresa of Avila, were shot by militiamen in the street. One died instantly. Another was at first refused transport to a hospital by a bus driver who wanted to, quote, finish her off. A third wandered around dazed until another band of militiamen executed her. The day after that, 14 seminaries died, but only after they'd been tortured. Attempts were made to get them to show disrespect to a crucifix. One was forced to try eating a rosary. A few weeks later, it was the turn of a bishop. On succeeding days, a pattern emerged. Several priests here, 10 Christian brothers there. By the end of the month, 124 priests were dead in Madrid, 197 in Barcelona. Mass was forbidden in the Republican Spain for the rest of the Civil War, except in the Basque provinces. Even allowing for the fact that tempers were hot at the moment, the slaughter of three helpless women, contemplative, shut away from the world no less, and the public executions of large number of harmless believers constituted repression on a scale not seen in Mexico or even in the Soviet Union. One of the accusations against the priests, of course, was that they hid weapons or perhaps participated in the fightings. Those charges were most often false. That didn't calm the fury. Churches and rectories were ransacked for incriminating evidence, and when none was found, destroyed anyway, along with any priest who happened to be nearby. Large numbers of priests and religious were torn out of seminaries, hospitals, and nursing homes and killed. Others were captured in schools and executed along with their young students. Still others were placed in front of popular tribunals and given the opportunity to save themselves by renouncing their Catholicism. Not one of them ever appears to have done so. And I suspect that you are like I am and find that quite inspiring. Actually, the opposite is true. The threat of imprisonment, torture, death almost always led to serious recommitment to the faith. We'll be back after the break. This is Chuck Coughlin.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. Welcome back. Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight. We were talking about the Spanish Civil War in the early part of the 20th century. It's a complicated story. There's half-heroes, heroes, villains, and half-villains. Certainly the Catholic martyrs were among the purest of heroes of this story. An interesting perspective on the Spanish Civil War is how it was viewed from the United States. There's quite a division of opinions. On one side were the Catholics. On the other side was the Protestant majority and the Jewish community. And if anyone had been alive back then, you would have been confused if these two elements in the press were talking about the same events, so differently were they presented. And subsequently, now we have battling historians. On one side, we have a much praised book that you can see on Amazon.com. That book is entitled The Spanish Holocaust, Inquisition and Extermination in 20th Century Spain. It's by Paul Preston. The title contains the word Inquisition. Well, my reaction to that title, it contains a reference to the Spanish Inquisition. I'm sorry, but the use of that term, for me, is a dead giveaway that the book may contain an anti-Catholic bias. I haven't read the book, but there's many reviews available on the Internet. Most of them praise the book for its scholarship, but almost all note the leftward bias, the bias toward the atheist, communist, Republican side in the conflict. Although the book is a long recitation of facts about the atrocities from both sides, the book is very definitely favors the leftist side. When you read the following comments on Amazon.com, in every comment praising the book, you read accusations against the Catholic Church of complicity in these atrocities. There's very little evidence, actually no evidence for that. But those accusations are widely believed by the small segment of the American public who are even aware of the Spanish Civil War. On the other side, you have Stanley Payne in his book, Franco and Hitler, Spain, Germany, and the World, Yale University Press, 2008, in which he said, the Spanish Civil War witnessed the most extensive and violent persecution of Catholicism in Western history, in some way even more intense than that of the French Revolution. More than 6,800 Catholic clergy were slaughtered, including 13 bishops, 2,360 monks and friars, 4,172 diocesan priests and seminarians, as well as 283 nuns. Thousands of churches were destroyed. Most of the intense killing occurred in the first 6 months of the three-year conflict. But by the end of the world, about 20% of the nation's Catholic clergy was dead. Another author, Robert Royal, in his book, The Catholic Martyrs of the 20th Century, A Comprehensive World History, year 2000, wrote that while researching the book at the Vatican in 1999, where records documenting new martyrs were maintained, some 13,000 causes had been forwarded from around the world. About half were from Spain. Robert Royal wrote that the Republicans, the communist atheist side, were just utterly unrestrained. Whole convents were killed, whole orders. It was very nasty. The Vatican tried to defend people as well as they could, but there was little they could do against increasingly radical forces controlling the government. When Robert Royal was asked about some claims that because the Spanish Catholic hierarchy had become too close to secular power, it allowed itself to become a target in political conflict, Royal acknowledged that in the Spanish case, there's plenty of room to criticize the church. But he pointed out the exemplary behavior of the bishops in the darkest days. He wrote that we often hear how Spanish bishops were corrupt, that they enjoyed being honored. Yet when the persecution started, every single one refused to flee the country. They were given every opportunity to renounce their faith before they were killed. But there were only two bishops who were not captured and killed, and that was because they happened to be out of the country on business. There is a producer from Spanish TV, Jose Nieto. He has amassed a 6,000-volume collection on the Spanish Civil War. Nieto said that the most recently available historical documentation demonstrates the central role played by the Soviet Union in manipulating political alliances in order to position the left to gain power as the, quote, popular front, with the Communist Party playing a critical but low-profile role, providing material support, including tanks and arms at the outset of the conflict, recruiting 40,000 mercenaries from around the world. These were called the International Brigades, and they also promoted strategies such as a murderous attitude toward Catholicism. The nature of these atrocities would have been different, not so brutal, if the outside influence was not as aggressive, observed Nieto. He described himself as a non-religious man who was yet very moved by the suffering experienced by Catholics during the war. It's a little difficult for us today to understand how so many Americans could have supported the leftists, the so-called Republican side of Freemasons, communists, atheists, and every sort of anti-Catholic. To conceive of how this could happen, you have to appreciate the power of the media, the power of the arts, the power of academia, which was deeply influenced by the propaganda and disinformation that had its origin in Soviet Russia. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade was composed of about 2,800 passionate young Americans who traveled to Spain to join the leftist side. It was an unlikely mixture of artists, journalists, industrial workers, and intellectuals, united in their desire to combat European fascism. In a book called War is Beautiful, James Newglass, a novelist, wrote his memoir about his service as a member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The kindest thing you could say about these people is that they were deceived. They were the useful idiots, full of a passionate intensity. But they were being misinformed. They were being disinformed. Later in the 1950s, many of the veterans of the Lincoln Brigades were investigated by HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee of the United States Congress. This bipartisan committee of the Congress had nothing to do with Senator Joe McCarthy. Before the committee, a large number of the members of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade admitted to being members of the Communist Party. Membership of the Communist Party was against the law. It had been forbidden by the Smith Act. The majority of these Lincoln Brigade veterans who were communists did abandon their membership of the Communist Party after that. Leftist media have portrayed this period as history as the Red Scare and was ridiculed as people who believed there was a communist hiding under every bed. In retrospect now, having much more information from the open KGB archive, we do know that we had extensive infiltration by communist agents. On the matter of the Spanish Civil War, the public in the United States was divided in opinion between the Catholics on one side and the Protestants and the Jewish community on the other side. Well, it was a war of words. It shows the power of the arts. Polls taken throughout the United States during the duration of the Spanish conflict tell a very clear picture. A majority of Roman Catholics supported the Franco uprising against the atheist government, but the Protestant and Jewish communities were virtually unanimous in their support of the Popular Front government. Rarely in American history has there been such a division upon religious denominational lines. All the Catholic work done in the interest of becoming accepted as Americans, which seemed so possible in the 1930s, was being destroyed by the Catholics' determined opposition to the Protestant majority. All parties agreed that they should not intervene militarily. America was in the midst of the isolationist 30s, in no mood for another European adventure. Another reason was that the religious aspect of the conflict was not made plain outside of the Catholic press, but underlying currents were brought to a head when the Spanish bishops issued a pastoral letter addressed from their beleaguered church to the whole world. The New York Times published it under the incendiary title, Spanish Prelates Justify Rebellion. Well, the war of words was on. You have to look at the actual text of the letter to gain some sense of it. The letter began by criticizing the presentation of the conflict in the secular papers of the world. Most of the media had been openly sympathetic with the leftist regime, especially in English language journals. The bishops were also at pains to thank the Catholic media for their spirited defense. The bishops protested their preference for peace and disavowed any complicity in the fomenting of the rebellion. They took special care to declare the illegitimacy of the 1936 elections, the actions of the Soviet Comintern, the communists, the arming of anarchist revolutionaries by the government, and the ceaseless attacks on the Catholic Church. They defended the rebellion using the just war theory of St. Thomas Aquinas and reluctantly admitted that military action was now the only way to return to some semblance of order. They framed the conflict in terms of resistance to, quote, the Asiatic slavery of Bolshevism by Christian civilization, thus clearly stating the religious purpose of the Civil War. They declared that the nationalist movement was a Christian one as well as a Catholic one. They ended by disclaiming the fiction that the church was rich. They protested, like the rest of Spain, that the church was extremely poor and that almost all of the clergy were taken from the ranks of the peasantry. Well, there was an immediate outcry among the nation's Protestants and in the Protestant press. 150 prominent Protestants of all denominations signed a letter against the Spanish prelates. The conflict was on. They were outraged that the Catholic Church would bless a rebellion against what they saw as a legitimate government. It confirmed an old bias that the Catholic Church was against popular democratic government, opposed to freedom of worship, and against the separation of church and state. These are the tired old cliches of American anti-Catholicism. So a war of words had begun, and after the break, we'll see how it continued. On Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin back after the break for our last segment on the Red Terror, the communist influence in the Spanish Civil War in the early part of the 20th century. A historical revisionist, as I sometimes am, might that view that war as a contest between atheist Marxism and a more traditional form of government that was pro-Catholic and tolerant. We've had a very slanted and biased anti-Catholic view invade our history books and our understandings and our movies and our novels by such elite authors as Hemingway. From some perspectives, most of our country was on the wrong side in that war. So let's go on with our story.
We were talking about the Spanish Civil War and the reaction and attitude in the United States towards it. There was a conflict over which of the two sides should have the support of the American people. Protestant ministers and theologians, critical of the Catholic Church's support of the right-wing nationalist government of Francisco Franco. In the Protestant letter, one can see that if there is not a positive contempt for the Spanish culture, there is at least no effort to appreciate the nation. Does this document, the Protestants have, had the support of the Vatican and of the Catholic Church in the United States? Above all, the Protestants rejected the assertion that this was a war against religion on one side and for religion on the other. They said it was a war between democracy and fascism. Well, American Catholic media wasted no time in the reply. There was a response from Monsignor Michael Reddy, the General Secretary of the National Catholic Welfare Conference. In a letter to the editor, he accused the Protestants of being the victims of communist propaganda and rehashing old arguments that had long since been refuted. He said they had created a straw man, which they criticized. It's interesting that their letter was not translated in Spanish and sent back to the Spanish bishops. That would have been in poor taste any case, as the body of bishops had already lost 11 to leftist death squads. A greater effort than that, 175 prominent Catholics wrote a joint response, which was published in the New York Times in 1937. October 14th. Just listen to some of the laymen and priests who signed it. It included Monsignor John Ryan, Father Talbot of the American Magazine, Bishop Fulton Sheen, Edmund Walsh of Georgetown, Carlton Hayes of Columbia, Alfred E. Smith, the presidential candidate, Pedro Gilday, the historian, and Martin Carmody of the Knights of Columbus. It's a Catholic who's who, About half were laymen, about half were clerics. It shows that the Catholic intellectuals and journalists and the clergy was totally behind the Spanish bishops. It turned out it was extremely effective and broad presentation of the unity of Roman Catholic opinion on the topic. There was no Protestant response this time. The American Catholics had answered the question of where they stood. The Catholic response emphasized the incursions of which Soviet Russia had made in the Spanish Popular Front government. They made a comparison to the American Revolution of 1776. They used wholly Americanizing language. Listen to this paragraph. The citizens of Spain, therefore, were justified by the right of self-defense in rising up against a malign power that was surely and inevitably destroying their country. Those who would deny them the exercise of this inalienable right would, with equal logic, have denied the American people that right. In 1776, the exercise of their inalienable right to rebel in arms against a government which suppressed their liberties. The letter went on to excoriate Protestants for supporting such a regime. The American Catholics implied the rebels were fighting for the same principles as George Washington. The fact that the comparison between Washington and the flawed Francisco Franco was far from adequate did not really matter. They'd made their statement. They were American Catholics standing with their brother and sister Catholics who were fighting the Red Menace. Finally, there was an official response of the American bishops. November 1937, the American Catholic bishops published a letter to the Spanish hierarchy thanking them for their letter. All of the hierarchy endorsed this document. The bishop decried the misstatements of the media, the misrepresentation of Spain's contribution to Western civilization. They stated that atheism and irreligion were the enemies which should be immediately confronted. They said, quote, Christian leaders who have allowed themselves to be sponsors of principles which have given wide sway would destroy the very last vestige of Western civilization. In addition to this, they sent a statement of solidarity to the German bishops, who were then embroiled in an actual battle for the church in the German fascist-controlled state.
There, the German prelates were standing forcefully against Bolshevism
and every other enemy of peace. Then there was a papal encyclical that declared very clearly, quote, in the worldwide conflict of today, between two diametrically opposed philosophies of life, the spiritual and the supernatural on one side, and the materialist on the other, there is no place for indifference or neutrality. The forces of atheism and neo-paganism, with their offspring communism and despotism, are attempting to rob life of all that is spiritual and supernatural. The fate of Western civilization, which is rooted in Christian principles, is bound up with the outcome of this struggle. To remain indifferent to what is happening before our very eyes is not only blameworthy, but is criminal. Though the war would drag on for almost two more years, the official position of the American Catholic Church was clear. The editorial line was maintained in the overwhelming majority of Catholic publications. The Church in the United States did not waver in its position against the leftist government in Spain.
Thing was confirmed by the blessing of Franco by the Pope
and his recognition of the nationalist government in 1938. The Catholic Church came into its own in the struggle as a primary political, social, and cultural motive force in American society. They had withstood the withering criticism of the Protestant majority in the United States and had the satisfaction of seeing the ultimate defeat of the forces of the leftist government in Spain in early 1939. The conflict was extremely formative for the young American church and would reflect its coming of age. Catholics of the period were confirmed in their unflinching anti-communism. It would make them considered as a group among the most loyal of citizens when the investigations against communism occurred in the 50s. They would be installed in more political roles. Anti-Catholicism would give way to anti-communism as the preferred prejudice of the 1950s. The church entered the 40s and 50s as a unified group with a common identity ready to face the challenges of those decades. It is ironic that the terrible bloodletting of Spain helped to bring forth a strong and tightly knit American Catholic presence. It was a great good, but it came about at a much too tragic price for Spanish Catholics. Much has been written about Franco's alleged fascism and brutality, but perhaps the English historian Paul Johnson had summed up his character the best. The nationalists, that's Franco, won primarily because of the capacity and judgment of Franco. Though Franco was an unlovely man, is unlikely ever to win the esteem of historians, he must be accounted one of the most successful public men of the century. The soldier statesman he most resembles is Wellington, a figure much admired in Spain. Franco was never a fascist or had the smallest belief in any kind of utopia or system of workers' paradise, which had proved so destructive in the other communist and socialist experiments that made the 20th century the bloodiest century in history. A century of genocides fostered by atheistic regimes of dictators. The century in which communist China wiped out perhaps 80 million of its own people in an effort to create a workers' paradise. Spain would have been something like that, or it would have resembled the Soviet Union with its system of gulags, of political prisoners, which at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall still had 11 million people working in slave labor camps in Siberia. Or perhaps we could take the example of the Communist People's Republic of China, which today has 8 million people in the Laogai, an estimated 11 million people. The Laogai is a system of slave labor camps producing products for the American market. These people are paid next to nothing. They work 12-hour days, 7 days a week, never get a break, never have a day off. They sleep on boards. They have very primitive facilities, no sanitation. They don't live long. All this because someone had a dream of a worker's paradise, an atheistic, communistic worker's paradise. If Franco had not won, the best could be hoped for Spain would be a nation with the characteristics of communist Cuba, where people have very little freedom, and there's an extensive system of political prisons. In any case, we can say at the end that although Francisco Franco was indeed a very unlovely man who did some terrible things, that had Franco not won, it would have been a terrible thing not only for Spain, but for the rest of the world. Because there would have been a communist, atheist country sitting at a critical point at the entrance to the Mediterranean, sharing a border with France, and just offshore of Britain. And just across the Strait of Gibraltar from the African continent. I've covered a subject that is an unpleasant subject, the Spanish Civil War. But I hope you, like me, find the example of the faithfulness of the martyrs to the Catholic Church and to Christ to be very inspiring and uplifting to contemplate. This has been Setting the Record Straight. Chuck Coughlin on breadboxmedia.com.